Good to be here. Thanks to the organizers. Thanks, everybody, for coming. Okay, let's see if I can get that up. Yeah, I just want to tell you some stuff that I've been thinking about to do with spin networks and simplicity of quantum gravity, and everybody kind of knows that these things are really related. In fact, I hadn't seen the poster before I came here, but you see it sort of loops, but the picture's got all these little colored tetrahedra things trickling down out of the sky. So there's a bunch of ideas, and it's really simple, and everything basically comes from taking everything absolutely literally. So I just want to remind you first that there's a 3+1 dimensional Reggie calculus. A lot of times people think about it in 4. Friedman and Jack did this back in 86. And it's, the idea is you can take flat tetrahedra, and if you give the areas and a volume, you can reconstruct everything that you'd like. You can reconstruct the curvature. Oops. Ah. What goes backwards? Oh, that's the wrong way around. Ah, there you go. I don't dare point. Okay, anyway, you can reconstruct everything you want. You can reconstruct the Ricci scalar. You can reconstruct, you can reconstruct you can reconstruct extrinsic curvature. You can reconstruct the metric. You can reconstruct the supermetric. You can reconstruct the entire thing. So if you thought you had a reason to believe that you had these fundamental little tetrahedra floating around, which actually had these little areas which you knew and these volumes which you knew, you could go back and reconstruct all kinds of stuff. This has well-defined Hamiltonian constraints that conserve momentum. But usually, I mean, certainly in this paper, but usually people imagine this is some sort of a classical approximation scheme, and it's hard to see. If you just start off with unconstrained little tetrahedra that you just drew, it's hard to see how you're going to wind up getting things like quantized areas or volumes or lengths or something out of it. Okay. Whoops, wrong way around. There you go. So this traditional approach is just to remind you, because I'm going to come back to this right near the very end because it's something interesting. You know how the Reggie calculus goes. I mean, everybody knows this. It's pretty simple. You wind up building, if in two dimensions, you build stuff out of little triangles, and if these guys don't match up, you wind up with a little angle, and the sum of those little angles winds up giving you the integrated curvature, and, you know, if it was a sphere, you'd wind up with 4 pi. If you do it in 3D, you wind up with lengths times these things. If you do it in 4D, you wind up with areas, and usually what you wind up doing is you vary those edge lengths for the dynamics, but you vary them pretty much as you'd like. This is usually a classical scheme. Okay, the dynamical triangulations, we saw this morning again as well. So this is kind of a variant where you don't actually leave the edge lengths dynamical, but you specify the dynamics in terms of connectivity. And we saw this morning at Jan Ambjorn's talk, which was great. But then there was this thought of, you know, what's this continuum limit? And, again, is this what you want? If you think the fundamental lumps of volume and area are actually discrete, is it obvious that you actually want some sort of a continuum limit? Okay. And then, of course, you want these causal dynamical triangulations and how you go about handling this, but I'll come back to that in a minute. Okay, here's the crux of it. It's kind of simple what I wanted to say, and it's basically all boiled into here, and then I'll say it a couple of different ways, and then I'll say something else. If you wanted to do some one of these quantum mechanical amplitudes, you'd try to define something like this, some sort of an integral over a bunch of geometries that interpolated between a couple of 3 geometries. It's hard to see when you do this. You might do something, try to get transition amplitudes between something and something, but it's hard to see how you'd get the quantized geometrical quantities to emerge. In fact, it's hard to see how you would, starting off with this, get whether or not those geometries were of the type that you would expect from the spin network stuff. That is to say, with these quantized areas and these quantized volumes. There's an analogy. Okay, here's the part where it's really obvious. There's an analogy if you did it with angular momentum, right? If you look at the classical phase space, there's this continuous thing where you've got an arrow stuck on a sphere and it can point around all over the place. If you had a quantum one, the space is really, really different. So, for example, that's spin 3. So I've got 6 little spin and a half punctures dropped down here. The way that these two look is radically different. It's really hard to see if you're trying to do a path integral, which is an integral of e to the I classical action for all sorts of configurations in here. It's hard to see that there's only some of those configurations that are actually physically allowed. So here's the big kicker, okay? You can either do path integrals where you're summing over a bunch of classical configurations, and then you have to hope like crazy that all of the classical ones you didn't want all cancel out, or you could just do a sum. And the fact that it's angular momentum, I mean, I'm saying it for angular momentum, but of course the quantum numbers are exactly the same as what you have for the spin networks. So you could do a straightforward path integral, and then the physical states, like the ones that you know are these things labeled by J and M, it's not obvious. If you just wrote down a path integral and you were doing it over angular variables, it'd be very difficult, at least it's very difficult for me to see how you're going to come out with the J's and the M's. Usually you'd go and you'd write down the canonical commutation relations and you'd find out what the J's and the M's were. The ones that you don't want, they're all going to wind up canceling out, but you have to get them to cancel out by summing up some monstrously huge number of things, which you hope in the end will wind up giving you the equivalent of what you would have got if you'd just done a finite sum over this. So in other words, the suggestion is, since let's assume that you believe what you got out of the spin networks, that you actually have these geometries that are specified by areas that are assigned to surfaces, little flat bits that are punctured by these lines, and little volumes that are specified in some sense by what the intertwiner is inside. Those are what you should probably use when you go to construct sums. They're the ones you already know the right answer. So in a sense, this is a suggestion that you could have the spin network stuff basically inform the geometry that you do for the discrete approaches. In other words, you don't just pick out random tetrahedra, whatever they happen to be, with any old regular things, or random whatever these little chunks are, and build things up. Use the ones that you know are the ones that are physically the right ones, because they're the ones that you already learned from the spin networks. That way, you don't wind up summing over a gazillion basically weird, wrong classical geometries, which you'd have to hope would wind up canceling out in the end. Okay? So this would be analogous to starting off an angular momentum calculation, using that you know that what the J's and the M's are, as opposed to trying to do some horrendous path integral over gazillions and gazillions of classical configurations that you hope, for the most part, will almost entirely cancel out. Okay, so this is the idea. The idea is, if you wanted to keep these discrete approaches like Regi or dynamical triangulations or causal dynamical triangulations, you could put the quantization of geometrical quantities that you've got out of spin networks in right from the very start. In other words, you know what the kinematic Hilbert space is. You could argue for something even semi-classical or maybe even a path integral by putting those in the first place. Don't pick random weird geometries that you know are basically wrong and then hope like crazy that if you add enough of them, all the wrong ones will cancel out and they'll leave you the ones that you wanted. Okay, so what is this get one? There's a few things that are kind of useful when you think about it. One of them is you immediately get a visualizable sort of simplicial geometry for every one of these spin networks. I mean, you draw the spin network, and then you draw all these little faces, and you have these little volumes, and it's something that you can look at and kind of make sense. It also gives you kind of, this is kind of cute. I mean, you guys probably all know this, but at some point, it's kind of obvious now why you need at least four edges to come out in order to get a volume, because you need at least four flat faces to enclose a volume. You get a huge reduction in the number of degrees of freedom if you're doing some Feynman-type sum. You could try and do the time evolution as well. I mean, you've got everything in here. There's one thing I wanted to mention in here as well, because it's another one of the points that I don't super understand. But I'd be perfectly happy, for example, taking like the evolution of rotations, of things, of spins, with a continuous time. It's not obvious. I don't know if John... Is John Stachel here? Because he keeps saying, what happens to, you know, would you wind up having a discrete time? Given, I mean, if you were doing an SO4, I might buy it. But given that, in a sense, I mean, to me, the reason that you wind up with the areas being quantized is essentially those are things that are conjugate to the things that are compact. They're the three compact generators out of SU2. So it's not obvious that the other ones that have to do with time would wind up giving you anything that was quantized at all. I mean, you might wick rotate, but then it's not obvious what you're doing. You're doing something else. And we saw that in the morning in Jan's talk, which I think was really interesting, which is that if you go and you try and do a Euclidean sum and you're not careful about putting in from scratch some notion of causality, at least picking out a restricted subset of those things, you wind up with some dopey answer that's wrong. Okay, interesting question for this. This is something else to think about. So that was a starter thing. There's an implicit something. I mean, again, I think there's a lot of people way more expert than me, but the spectrum of the volume operator looks really amazingly complicated to me, okay? There's an implicit idea in here somewhere that somehow or other when you build up these little simplices with volumes that are specified by the intertwiner in the middle and edges with areas that are given by the edges that come out, faces with areas that are given by the edges that come out, it's not immediately obvious that the volume and the area are going to match up for what you'd want if you thought that was actually a little piece of flat three space. And in fact, it's obvious sometimes that that's exactly what doesn't happen, because you can have a four-valent node, for example, which doesn't have a zero volume. You can degenerate that one out, in which case you haven't got the right amount of volume inside for the four faces that you kind of like. So there's a suggestion as well, while I'm up here just babbling about things, which is if that you do this loop quantum gravity type quantization, if you wound up with pieces that were inconsistent with being flat, then you might find that flat space-time wasn't consistent itself. You might grow an effective cosmological constant, or you might see one of these interesting deformations. I don't know how much people looked at this. This is the old Snyder-Yang-Mendes algebra, where what you do is you take the Poincaré algebra, normally, as it stands, and then you also take the Heisenberg one, so the commutator of X and P being I, and you ask, what's the minimal thing you could write down that's stable and contains all those things? And it turns out there's a two-parameter deformation. So the X's wind up having a commutator, the X mu and the X nu wind up having a commutator, and there's some length scale, which you probably guess is kind of like the Planck scale. But the P commutators also appear. So P mu, P nu now also winds up having a commutator, and it looks like 1 over some other length. So there's a two-parameter deformation. I don't know if this is the sort of thing that might just naturally pop out if one actually took seriously, looked at what the spectrum of all the, for all the little simplices, all the things you could associate to vertices in a spin network, count up the areas around the outsides, count up the volumes inside, and see whether or not at least some fraction of those things don't wind up looking like something that you would piece together to make something flat. I mean, for example, you could make one easy one. You just take zillions of tetrahedra. It's space-filling, flat, and everything's fine. Okay. Locality issues. This is Fotini and Lee earlier on this year. I would argue this was a worry about these non-local links. So what happens if you build up one of these? That's supposed to be a piece of a spin network. But you wind up with these things that are sort of far away. Is this some sort of bad non-locality? Well, I argue if you wind up doing this, really, if you were to go back and think about drawing these little simplices, what you actually have to do is you have to bend this space a huge amount to get a face over here to match up with a face over there. So these are things that, that correspond to really large three curvatures. And I'd argue you probably want these things to wind up being dynamically suppressed. These are probably positive curvatures. That's just a random thought. I don't know how much this is connected to things like positive energy theorems, which might be interesting. So models for flat quantum space, in principle, if you wanted to, you could pick a state which at least somehow approximates a flat quantized space-time and has kind of the right limit. You just take zillions of tetrahedra. You build a tetrahedral spin network. You take lots and lots of these things. There's no deficit angles between the whole lot. If you were to step way back, it would look kind of like you discretize something, but at the end, it's chunky if you go close, but it's kind of the right flat limit. You can find solutions. Remember, this is in a 3 plus 1. You can find solutions to the ADM equations just by putting the extrinsic and intrinsic curvature equal to 0, right? If you take all that junk, it tells you how much density of matter there is in there. So if you set all that equal to 0, that just means you haven't got anything in there. So now you've got a flat 3 curvature, you've got no extrinsic curvature, you've got no matter in there, and that looks a lot to me like something that's flat. I don't know what happens. Again, I don't understand well enough what the spectrum of the volume operator looks like and how it's connected to the little simplices that you'd pull out, which don't have to be tetrahedra now. So if you get these little defects in here, I don't know what that means. Like with those little defects, if they were associated with something that was basically curved, so in other words, you didn't match up with the area of the faces on around that, whatever the simplex was, and the volume of what was inside, hey, is that somebody agreeing or somebody mad? Then I think you'd have to say that you thought that was a little piece of curved something. So if you had that sitting in there, I don't know, what's a little curved, defecty something look like? I mean, maybe that's a particle. I don't know. And while you're at it, I should mention, while you're at it, you can imagine when you take, if you take the tetrahedra, okay, this is in passing, so I get nuttier as we go along. If you take the tetrahedra, you can uniquely go back and reconstruct all those geometrical quantities that you wanted. If you choose more faces, you don't get a unique reconstruction back. That means, presumably, you've got some sort of internal degrees of freedom. Okay. I don't know. It sounds interesting. It's just a thing to follow up on sometime. And then last thing is, there might even be a kind of connection to... Oh, a shot pass. Hang on a second. There might even be something connected to strings working in here. I like taking I'm very conservative, actually. I like taking things that we think we know and pushing them as hard as they can go before you go inventing weird things. You remember way back when an early transparency, I drew that little cartoon about how regicalculus works, right? And if you're in two dimensions, you basically have a bunch of these triangles, and then there's a gap where you'd have to pull them together. So the curvature, the defect, if you like, where something interesting happened, is zero-dimensional. It's right at that point where these things, where you've got to pull them together, when it was that little wedged-up thing, you've got to pull those together, and the curvature's at a point. In three dimensions, and here I'm arguing for 3 plus 1, in three dimensions, the defects are along one-dimensional things. So in other words, the curvature here in two-dimensional is distributional at points. In three dimensions, which is what I'm talking about here, the curvature is distributional along lines. I guess distributional curvature along a line is something that's kind of like a string. I don't know what that means, but it's kind of interesting. I don't know what that actually would wind up putting on restrictions on the dynamics if you wanted to count those as somehow matter. Is that stringy matter? I think Alejandro's talking about this on Wednesday. In the BF theories, there's some naturality of coupling to stringy matter, and this looks like something that's sort of natural in the context of this stuff. And, okay, here you go. There's the last bit. So I guess what I'm saying is it might make sense to take what you learned about quantized geometry from loop quantum gravity and then go take everybody else who likes doing the simplicial stuff and use that as input. In other words, take the spin network stuff seriously and then don't use discrete like simplicial geometries that you know basically all have to cancel out in whatever it was you were trying to do quantum mechanically. So in a sense, these two things are sort of dual to each other. Again, I don't know, maybe somebody's done this, but I don't see it in the literature. I think this business of understanding the volume operator a little better and trying to figure out if the little blocks are genuinely flat, if they're really consistent with flat or not, So I could imagine that maybe once you finish quantizing what you thought was regular plain old general relativity, maybe you wind up with the local Lorentz group and Poincaré and whatnot. Maybe at the end you wind up picking up something that's a deformation after the quantization. There's lots of places where this happens, I should tell you. For example, if you build the Wigner operators, the Newton-Wigner operators, for example, for a photon, right? And you have a photon, you say, I want to assign a position to it. The X's in quantum field theory, they're dummies, right? You integrate over the X's, they're labels in the fields. When you go back and try and make an X operator, if that's a photon going like that, you can give it a, this is the Z axis. You can give it a well-defined Z, but the X and the Y position operators commute. It's true for everything with a spin. So you wind up with an induced non-commutative geometry in space for the position operator for a photon. So after quantization, the geometry's got, if you like, the commutation relations, which were trivial, between X, Y, and Z, have wound up being deformed. So maybe something like that happens, but I'd have to understand a lot better what the spectrum of the volume operator winds up looking like, and in conjunction with whatever all the areas of the things that enclose that volume would be. And if you do all this stuff and take it seriously, you even see something vaguely stringy that ought to be associated with curvature. I mean, I'm the last guy to say something nice about strings, but, you know, I'm honest. I call them like I see them. So I see something stringy kind of lurking around in here. And so at the end, there's so many people with all these different approaches, and I just see a lot of these things kind of touching on kind of the same thing, maybe. So maybe, I mean, this is such a nice community because people are all so sort of friendly and open-minded. I was just wondering if it's possible that everybody doing all these different things is at least all partially right simultaneously. And gracias. So that was what I wanted to say. Thanks.